Welcome to the Docs Who Lift podcast, where we distill and simplify the complexities of a healthy lifestyle, exercise, medicine, and weight loss. We're excited to bring you a podcast that's a prescription for clinical practice, scientific recommendations, and just real life. This is the Docs Who Lift podcast.
I never let the intro go to the end, by the way. And I just, I'm like, please stop it. All right.
Hey, yo.
Welcome back to the Docs Who Lift podcast. I'm your host, Dr. Spencer Nadolski. I'm my co-host, Dr. Carl Nadolski Jr. And I got, again, here, Dr. Alex Bonacase. And today we are going to be talking about hypogonadism again. If you need to know kind of the general basis of hypogonadism, please refer to the last podcast. And this time, though, we're going to be talking about obesity in terms of hypogonadism as they relate closely to each other. And Dr. Bonacase happens to have a strong interest in this along with us. He's an obesity physician specialist along with an endocrinologist and into andrology, kind of the study of these sex steroids. So let's discuss it. So what's the deal here? If you have obesity, you're going to have low T. What's going on?
Yeah, and I think so. This is a really important topic and something we deal with all the time. And you know, I had the honor of discussing it at the ACE Obesity Conference. And you know, I think one of the things that makes it hard, it's sort of a chicken or the egg thing. And so a lot of times patients, they get told they have low testosterone. They also have the disease of obesity, and they maybe are getting treated for their testosterone without thinking about the whole aspect. So I really want people to kind of understand that most of the time when the patient has obesity as a chronic disease, hypogonadism often presents as a functional type of, it's an adiposity-based complication of functional low testosterone. And what does that really mean? It's essentially meaning that because of the metabolic changes, the changes in adipokines and the pro-inflammatory state, there are multiple mechanisms that essentially decrease the pituitary signaling. There's decreases in changes in sex hormone binding globulin, changes in estrogen, and then even changes directly at the testis in terms of production of testosterone. And so I'll give just a brief overview as we're chatting, but I mean, I want people to kind of understand that this whole concept of functional versus organic hypogonadism, where obesity, diabetes, states such as overexercise that we were talking about previously, maybe medications like opioids or steroids, those are kind of causing a functional impact on the hypothalamic pituitary testicular axis in that the body's responding to the disease state or the medication state. And it's not that there is a intrinsic kind of structural or disorder going on there like a tumor. It's just responding to the physiologic state that the body's currently in. So obesity is a chronic disease, which we'll talk about. That has a ton of impact on the signaling of testosterone in terms of changes in estrogen levels. So that kind of leads to the chicken or the egg. Is it obesity causing the low T or low T causing obesity? There's been debate about this. My opinion most of the time, it's that the obesity is creating the low testosterone as a functional kind of adiposity-based complication, which we'll talk about. What do you guys think about that? Do you think it's obesity causing the low T? What's kind of your thought?
So, you know, certainly it can be both ways, right? I mean, you know, men who have hypogonadism, it's not cardiometabolically healthy, right? So if they have a hypothalamic pituitary tumor that's causing secondary hypogonadism, or if they have primary testicular failure, I think we have enough data to show that that's not helpful for them, for their body composition, and that treatment generally helps that. But it's, again, it's not causing severe excess adiposity, you know, obesity. And certainly it seems like the most common cause of low testosterone hypogonadism certainly seems to be this functional obesity-associated secondary sort of hypogonadism. What do you think, Spence?
Yeah. So if somebody has a primary or another pathological cause of their hypogonadism, whether it's secondary or primary, you do see changes in body composition, less muscle mass, what we talked about before, despite trying to work out hard, and you know, obviously fatigue, you just don't feel well. So you start seeing, you know, maybe a little increase in adipose tissue, and then decreases in muscle mass. So you can have even a normal BMI, refer back to our Diagnosis of Obesity podcast, and you start seeing kind of this sarcopenic type of picture of sarcopenic obesity. Kind of, they look normal, you know, clothes, BMI, the anthropometric type of stuff, but they probably have obesity. That would be that. But what we don't see is kind of this more, you know, classic obesity of class 1, 2, 3, where they have a BMI of 30, and the hypogonadism caused that pronounced adiposity. What we see is that the adiposity then causes the hypogonadism in more of these kind of metabolic syndrome type patients, where they store most of the fat around their abdomen is usually what I see. If they have other metabolic abnormalities, that's more so where I see this male associated secondary hypogonadism or obesity related low T. So I think it can be both. Obviously, it doesn't help, and then it's a vicious cycle.
Well, I was just going to say, you know, to kind of refer to our prior podcast, you know, it's still important to get the the proper diagnosis workup right. You don't want to say, oh, it's just because they have chronic obesity, blah blah blah. Don't even check this stuff. No, we're not saying that. We're just saying that's usually going to be the cause, but you still need to kind of be systematic and go through the proper workup, because patients with a BMI of 50 still get prolactinomas, right? They still get hemochromatosis. So, I mean, I think that that's something that definitely not saying don't skip the workup, but it's usually the most common cause. And I guess one thing, you know, do you want me to talk a little bit about kind of some of the physiology briefly, or do you want to talk
go over
about
the pathophysiology? I think it's really interesting.
I think people are interested in the leptin and the kisspeptin. And, you know, my friends in fellowship used to make fun of me for the kisspeptin, talking about that stuff. So to go through all that stuff, it's fun and it shows that there's this underlying issue.
Yeah. Yeah. So the etiology of male hypogonadism and obesity, there's probably 10 plus mechanisms, but the major ones, you know, a big one is increased aromatization of testosterone to estradiol by the adipocytes. So we'll go over that in detail. There's leptin, insulin resistance. There's a shift towards just more pro-inflammatory adipokines as the adipose cell becomes unhealthier as obesity worsens and metabolic dysfunction, and then ultimately decreased kisspeptin signaling. So I'll just briefly kind of speed through some of these. So aromatase, you know, a lot of time, and this actually has a lot of kind of relevant applications to some of the low T clinics, but aromatase is an enzyme that converts testosterone to estradiol. And it's generally, you know, it's present in many different tissues, generally found in adipose, gonads, brain, skin, bones, but about 80% of that circulating estradiol in men, it's derived from aromatizing your androgen pool to estradiol. So we know that as your adipocyte mass increases, you have more tissue to aromatize testosterone to estradiol. So they've had studies even dating back to the early 70s showing that estradiol increases pretty much linearly in men as their body weight goes above the ideal range. And so what does this do? It's essentially the high estradiol, what it's doing, testosterone is directly decreased because you're taking away from that pool of T, turning it to E to estradiol. And then estradiol has a negative effect on the HPT axis, actually dampening that GnRH secretion, which decreases your LH and FSH. So not only are you taken away from your...
Tell people what those are, though.
Oh, gosh. Yeah. Sorry. I'm speaking Greek again. No. So what happens is you're taking the testosterone pool, taking more of that and converting it to estrogen. And that estrogen is actually signaling in the hypothalamus and pituitary. So your hypothalamic pituitary testicular axis, so the brain essentially talking to your testicles, it's dampening with that signaling, and it's decreasing those molecules from the hypothalamus and pituitary that talk to the testes. So that is one of the big reasons. So you're lower in that pool of testosterone, and then the byproduct of that is actually dampening the signaling from the brain to the testicles. So that is why that can be a major effect, especially since it increases linearly with adipose mass. And that kind of is where we're seeing some of the quack clinics. They're giving these aromatase inhibitors. They're saying, okay, if I can block the conversion of testosterone to estrogen, maybe I'm going to break that whole cycle. And, you know, I think we've all talked about this. It sounds nice in practicality, but there was a great study in New England Journal 2013 by Finkelstein and his team they actually gave guys that were hypogonadal, they said, we'll give you testosterone or we'll give you testosterone plus an aromatase inhibitor called anastrozole. And the group that got the aromatase inhibitor, they actually had an increase in central adiposity. They had worsening of sexual dysfunction. And it wasn't in this particular study, but there's other studies showing that there's detrimental effects of using aromatase inhibitors in men on bone health. So their conclusion was basically, hey, it's not really beneficial to give these guys aromatase inhibitors, and it's probably harmful on the metabolic effects, on the sexual function. So I think that it's really kind of, to me, a red, as you would say, a red flag of quackery when we start seeing these aromatase inhibitors thrown on these guys with low T to see if we can, you know, the body's a lot smarter than we realize, and it's not as simple as throwing these aromatase inhibitors. What do you guys think about kind of the anastrozole and kind of the sidebar there? But
yeah, I don't use anastrozole on anybody.
I don't use it. Yeah.
No, I mean, yeah, not in this context at all.
Right. Right.
The pathophysiology is really interesting in that. So you get basically a double whammy. You dampen the signal from the brain to the testicles, and then you dampen, and then you lower your pool of testosterone to estrogen, or you increase the estrogen from your testosterone. But the answer isn't necessarily just to give an aromatase inhibitor. I would say the answer is probably to lower the adiposity. That would be the best answer. What about the brain? Go into the kisspeptin, leptins type of stuff.
Absolutely. So, and then they've even had studies in this, you know, going back to basic science studies where you have mice in the lab where they actually knock out that aromatase gene. So they don't have aromatase, so they won't be converting as much of that testosterone to estrogen. And when you knock out that aromatase, those mice actually get significantly increased amounts of central adiposity and they get metabolic dysfunction. There are studies of patients that actually had a genetic mutation where they didn't have aromatase in proper levels. And those patients had osteoporosis early. They're all men. They didn't have fused bone plates. They had increased metabolic dysfunction. And a lot of them got better with estradiol replacements. So I think a big misnomer is that estrogen is bad in men. It's not that it's bad. It's bad to have too much and it's bad to have too little, because I've definitely seen patients from urology where they were given like maybe letrozole or anastrozole for the purpose of increasing their sperm count, and the goal was fertility, but their sex drive was dead because their estradiol was down to zero. And really, two of the most important hormones for a man's sex drive are DHT, dihydrotestosterone, and estradiol. So the balance of that is important. And I think we're getting too cute if we think we can manipulate it with a pill to try and outsmart the body and mitigate that. So I totally agree.
Yeah. So let's go into the brain physiology of the signaling and the secondary adiposity effects from it. Cause I think this also relates to the secondary hypogonadism that I talked about with dieting too much. It's a different mechanism. But it's kind of similar in that there's a signal from leptin or with the kisspeptin that basically the brain downregulates the signal. But I don't know if Dr. Bonacase wants to go into depth into that. But there's obviously a dampening signal from the inflammation that you get from your excess adiposity.
Yeah, I can be brief about leptin. So leptin is something that I think a lot of us in the endocrine and just, you know, medicine background, we think of that as a hunger hormone, where the healthy adipocyte, it makes leptin, it goes to the arcuate nucleus and gives us appropriate satiety. Kind of like we have insulin resistance in a lot of metabolic states. When people develop excess adiposity and obesity as a disease, they often get resistant to leptin's effects. So not only does that increase their appetite because you're not able to kind of appropriately signal in the arcuate nucleus, leptin also plays a pretty significant role in signaling of what Casey talked about, you know, the kisspeptin neurons and this GnRH pathway. So how it essentially works is you're not only having an increase in appetite, so you're losing that regulatory mechanism. So patients that struggle with weight are going to struggle more, unfortunately, because their appetite regulation is impaired. They're also going to have that dampening in that of the brain signaling, so they don't have as much testosterone production. And there's even literature, it was in 1999, they did a study on this. They even found that at the level of the testis, leptin resistance actually causes patients to not respond to the signaling from the brain as well at the level of the testicle. So they actually gave patients HCG, which is essentially an analog of LH. So for all intents and purposes, we're giving the signal from the brain that should tell the testicles, hey, make testosterone. And they didn't respond as well in patients that had leptin resistance. So not only are you dampening the signal up in the brain, you're also dampening it down in the testicle as well by impairing the production. So yeah, it's incredibly complex and you're hitting this pathway through like 10 plus different ways that is impairing it purely from the disease of obesity. And I'll rush through some of this other stuff really quick and then get to kisspeptin. But basically, as the fats, I think that you guys talk about this a lot as well, people sometimes think of adipose cells as this kind of unflattering storage tissue that we have. But as you guys have both talked about, adipose is a very active endocrine gland, right? It makes hundreds of different hormones called adipokines. When fat is healthy, it makes anti-inflammatory adipokines. When the body fat gets too high and the fat cell becomes unhealthier, it gets unhappy and makes more pro-inflammatory markers, increases that inflammation, that ultimately has an effect on decreasing the hypothalamic signaling. So the unifying pathway that you guys talked to is sort of this kisspeptin protein where there's these neurons in the brain called the kiss neurons that control kisspeptin signaling. And the whole thing that kisspeptin does is it starts that cascade to release the GnRH, LH. It kind of starts that signaling down to the testicle. So the four of the major factors that really downregulate the kisspeptin signaling, if you have leptin resistance, you can't have leptin help with that pathway. So leptin resistance is hurting kisspeptin signaling. Estradiol is impairing it. The inflammatory adipokines are impairing it. And also insulin resistance is also playing a role. So you have a multi-pronged layer of issues kind of impairing this signaling. So it's not hard to see why guys who struggle with obesity, they get this functional hypogonadism.
So let's go into like then treating it. Would you check the diagnosing any different from what we talked about in the hypogonadism diagnosis portion? You talked about last time how there could be slight difference. Yeah.
Yeah, so I would say there's an important step early on, and you know I'm getting kind of what we talked about. I'll get a morning testosterone, but if they have an elevated BMI, I'm off the bat. I'm getting the sex hormone binding globulin and albumin because it's very common in the disease of obesity for patients to have a low total testosterone, but then a normal free testosterone. And people might be going, "What the heck does that mean?" Well, free testosterone, to the best we know and the best theory that's out there, free testosterone is really what matters in terms of cellular signaling. So let's just say I'm just going to make this up. Let's say you have a patient who has a total testosterone of 500, but then they have really bad hyperthyroidism and they may have a huge storage pool of testosterone, but a very small fraction of that is free to actually act on the target cells and signal and have that effect. So maybe the total testosterone looks good, but the free testosterone that is functional at the cellular level, that's low, and they would biochemically kind of have a degree of hypogonadism. Now, flip the script. If a patient has obesity, that generally lowers these binding proteins called sex hormone binding globulin. So their total testosterone can be quite a bit lower, like maybe it's 220 or something, for example, or 200. But if they have a very low number of sex hormone binding globulin, more of that is free to act on the cell. So if a patient has a low total testosterone of 200, but that free testosterone is in the reference range or it's normalized, they do not have true biochemical hypogonadism. I call it pseudo hypogonadism. They look like they have it. They're probably going to get a prescription because people maybe not are thinking to look for that, but that's important to diagnose too. Before I even start getting down the nitty gritty algorithm, checking prolactin, all that, I try to see, is this pseudo hypogonadism or is this true biochemical hypogonadism? Is that similar to what you guys do or any kind of differences?
There's so much of that too. And not just, you know, talking about the disease of obesity, but, even sarcopenic obesity. So the thin people with high waist circumference and everything, I mean, they have insulin resistance, which lowers their sex hormone binding globulin, like you said, and they don't actually have hypogonadism, even if it would have been functional hypogonadism. They just don't have it. So we got to, you know, look at other things, again, being very holistic and, you know, and whatnot. So yeah, absolutely. You know, the other thing you talked about, hyperthyroidism, it always makes me think about one of the board questions is actually in patients with HIV. You know, the guy comes in with absolute clinical hypogonadism. He feels miserable. He has no libido. no erections in the morning, low muscle mass, and his testosterone is 800. So he's, they're like, nope, I guess you don't have low testosterone. But actually, his sex hormone binding globulin was through the roof. So he actually has really low free testosterone. That's a literal board question for, maybe it's only for endocrinologists. But anyway, something to think about for, you know, patients and anybody else, just to understand that why that is.
I think it's important for patients and clinicians to know that type of stuff. So
yeah. Well, so let's talk about the most important stuff now. Like in Revenge of the Nerds, when the football coach said, "Well, if I was you, I'd do something about it." So what are we going to do? So we do an evaluation for somebody. They have obesity. We say they have hypogonadism, but they don't have an organic disease. They don't have hypothalamic pituitary disorder. They're not on medications. They don't have testicular disease. We think they have functional obesity-associated male secondary hypogonadism. So what? So what are we going to do? Are we going to give them something called clomiphene that might be discussed? We're not going to do aromatase inhibitors, we don't think. Testosterone replacement therapy might be considered. But I think we all are going to want to enforce treating the underlying root cause, and that is their adiposity. So tell us about that. What are some of the data for that?
Yeah, there's great data that, you know, patients that are using either lifestyle and caloric restriction or bariatric surgery, which tends to obviously have a more robust effect on weight loss. There's a really nice meta-analysis. The patients that had bariatric surgery and lost more weight, they had a kind of an expected rise in a proportionate rise in testosterone based on the amount of adiposity they lost. So there is great data. We know factually that when patients have this functional hypogonadism and they lose weight in terms of decreasing their adiposity, the testosterone does go up. Now, I think one of the challenges is we have to avoid that trap. And this is where I think we really shine as obesity docs is, you know, if we say, okay, well, the testosterone's because you're overweight, you need to lose weight, you need to work on that, that doesn't help anybody. We all talked about that. We all know. So I transition a lot of these kind of visits to weight management, and I try to work with them very closely, maybe see them every couple weeks or monthly if they're wanting to engage on that. And I kind of go down that whole weight management pathway, and I start a lot of them. I end up, if it's appropriate, I end up starting them on a GLP-1 receptor agonist. I've seen the testosterone go up a heck of a lot with these medications and just working on weight loss. I had one patient where we ended up doing Q-Simia because he got sent to me for pseudo hypogonadism. I start talking with him and he really was struggling with a lot of kind of the, you know, evening snacking, just a lot. Like once you started actually talking to the patient, it became very clear what was going on, and he responded incredibly well to kind of targeted pharmacotherapy. So I take it as an opportunity to really help out and put my obesity doc hat on. I think you guys probably do exactly the same.
Yeah, most people that come in, I try to help them lose weight. Here's the issue, though. They're feeling like crap. They're trying to lose weight. Yes, you know, the GLP-1, we're going to have a discussion on that. These weight loss medicines can work and help them feel like they can do it. But some still lack the motivation to get into the gym. Not that that helps with a lot of weight loss, but it can certainly help with kind of the adiposity and muscle mass type of thing. And they just kind of lack this energy. And that's, you know, it's a vague symptom and not a reason to necessarily go on testosterone. But if they have low testosterone plus some of these symptoms, what we talked about in the diagnosis, I've had it both ways. Their testosterone will go from, what, 200 or so total testosterone with a low free testosterone. It'll go up to the 400s. I don't typically see it go into the 600-700s or so, but I see it usually get into the higher 400s. And sometimes they're feeling better, but not all the way necessarily, but they feel better and they continue to feel better as they lose weight. Then there's some others that will get into like the 300s. They still have symptoms. And this is where I'm like, well, you know, I don't know. It's worth a shot. Let's try some testosterone with it. And I've seen some of these people excel so well to where they get up into their 700-800s of total testosterone, and their motivation and energy just increases. So I kind of play it by ear with the people. We kind of give it some time. We don't jump to testosterone therapy. We discuss the risks and benefits, just like always. But I'm okay with trying it, testing it out with some people, not going super physiological.
And we do have good longitudinal data for that.
Yeah, and if at their levels terrible, or like you said, if it's that chicken or the egg, like they're having trouble with their weight loss, obviously we're not prescribing testosterone as a weight loss med, but if the hypogonadism is that symptomatic, I've definitely done the same thing in terms of when they're still hypogonadal, they're not able to, I think that I try to start with the weight loss, but I do go to that sometimes. And I've actually had some success using off-label clomiphene in some of these guys as a limited course. Clomiphene for the audience, it's essentially a medicine that started as sort of a female fertility drug. It's essentially a mix of two medicines, but it has a predominating effect of blocking estrogen effects at the pituitary and hypothalamus. You kind of reset that whole pathway we're talking about, maybe get up your signaling to the testes. I've personally had good success using clomiphene just for a couple months as kind of a reboot almost in these guys. Maybe I'm working on weight management. I've done a limited, pretty closely monitored, just very limited course of clomiphene. I've seen some good effects with that, obviously off-label, but has pretty good safety data up to 7-8 years. I don't love leaving people on that indefinitely. I tend to have it as a kind of bridge to try to the next phase. But yeah, no, that's just kind of some things I've tried. And I don't use aromatase.
Yeah, I'm right on the same page. Yeah, I guess I did that more when I was in the military, maybe because of the different types of people, you know, different age groups. So obviously we have to personalize therapy, right? So we may run into people who have obesity, hypogonadism, who want to absolutely make sure they're preserving their fertility. They're trying to, you know, have a family and whatnot. And so that may be a time to use clomiphene. You know, some could even argue doing the HCG, you know, for those who, we don't need to get into that with patients necessarily, but there are some options for that. Interestingly though, talking about treating the root cause, I just noticed that there was a meta-analysis literally just published like last week, talking about bariatric surgery for people with obesity, hypogonadism, and, so the bariatric surgery showed that not only did it improve all the testosterone levels and everything like that, but it improved sperm count and potential fertility. So in those, you know, younger, still needing to have a family, again, more argument for intensive weight loss therapy, whether it's diet, exercise, plus or minus medications, plus or minus surgery, to treat the root cause of this disease. You know, so that's kind of interesting. It was in Annals of Medicine and Surgery, the effects of bariatric surgery on male and female fertility, by the way. So of interest.
So takeaways from this, if you have obesity and you're feeling tired, low libido, that type of thing, you could get checked. But if you get checked, just know that, you know, first of all, yeah, they should do a secondary workup as we discussed last episode with, you know, the prolactin and all these different things, ferritin, but, probably related to your obesity, your excess weight. And probably the best thing to do is to try to lose the weight. And again, if it's tough, that's where talking with an obesity specialist physician would be ideal. And then there's still help if you need it. Again, I add back some testosterone for those who it's like, it's not cutting it. They've lost more than 10, 15% of their weight and they're still kind of feeling down and libido is low and their testosterone's right on that border. I have no problem adding back physiological doses, but I think the first step would be for most people to, hey, find someone to help you lose weight first before jumping on the T wagon, going to a testosterone replacement place, getting some aromatase inhibitors, 200 milligrams of cypionate a week. Some people are even giving out, I've seen some people giving out nandrolone, decanoate, and
oh yeah it's a compounded there's compounded pharmacies now. They have I have memorized all these different stacks. Yeah, they're using deca durabilin, they're using oral winstrol, they're using all kinds of
I didn't
stuff.
Know that it's was insane. FDA approved. I know oxandrolone, which is Anavar.
Of course it's not. I don't think it is that. I think they're getting it like it's totally, these things are all going to get shut down.
I can't believe nandrolone, it's like, wow, really?
Yeah. Avoid the quacks.
Even nandrolone kind of blows my mind. I mean, yeah, that's a whole nother podcast. Nandrolone's a synthetic 19-nor kind of testosterone that pretty hardcore anabolic steroid that can disrupt things in a lot of different ways, especially, yeah. So
that's some interesting stuff. So that's about the gist. So if you have obesity, don't just go to the tea clinics and get some tea. Lose some weight. Obviously, easier said than done. Sometimes you add testosterone to help you feel better. And I've been able to wean people off. I actually use a lot of the HCG and Clomid to wean people off of the testosterone because it helps. As
I think that's
Dr.
great.
I've
definitely done the same. How many memes a day do you recommend for weight loss, Spencer?
Two to three memes a day, along with a good podcast once a week. So,
sounds
all right.
Good.
Yeah, thanks, Dr. Bonacase. Here's our outro.
This podcast is for entertainment and education and information purposes only. Remember, the physicians on this podcast are not your physician. It should not be considered professional or personalized medical advice. It should not be used to replace speaking with your physician or medical professional to discuss your specific health concerns. The topics discussed should not be used solely to diagnose or treat any condition. As a result, we are not responsible for any unwanted medical outcomes. The views and opinions discussed are of those of the host only and do not represent those of any other entities. We'll be right back.